Allora, riprendiamo, sicuramente arriveranno i soliti ritardatari del sabato mattino consacrato al riposo, ai lavori di casa, alla spesa, eccetera. Va bene, però noi dobbiamo iniziare. Velocemente vi dirò come si svolge la giornata di oggi. Però dico due cose veloci, un rapido ragguaglio. Ieri abbiamo introdotto il nostro convegno, abbiamo avuto le relazioni, diciamo, di carattere più generale, culturale-teorico. Ha iniziato Walter Baier, Ernesto Laclau ci ha dato il suo contributo sul concetto di populismo. Andrea Fumagalli ha spiegato le ragioni della frammentazione del lavoro e soprattutto della importanza oggi del lavoro precario e quindi anche il fatto che si offre un terreno in più per questo populismo e queste estreme destre che tanto ci preoccupano. René Monza ha fatto un paragone fra i vecchi populismi che abbiamo conosciuto nel Novecento, populismi di estrema destra, eccetera, eccetera, con i nuovi populismi e con il caso esemplare del Front National come descrizione analitica, quindi anche dei casi nazionali. E subito abbiamo iniziato con i casi nazionali ed è in primo luogo Gerd Wiegel ci ha ragguagliato della situazione tedesca, della Germania, alcuni casi nazionali. Non abbiamo avuto la possibilità appunto di avere analiticamente, dettagliatamente i vari, ieri dicevo appunto che casi importanti come quelli in Scandinavia, Svezia, Norvegia, appunto per difficoltà di avere un relatore, eccetera, abbiamo dovuto cancellare. Però ricordavo che Saverio Ferrari, per quanto riguarda le estreme destre, oltre a parlare dell'estrema destra in Italia, farà un affresco nello spazio di una relazione rispetto allo all'intera Europa. Subito dopo Roberto Biorcio ha dato un quadro analitico della Lega Nord, per quanto riguarda l'Italia ricordo che oltre alla Lega Nord, quindi l'estrema destra italiana, poi appunto sarà Saverio. Dopo Roberto Biorcio abbiamo avuto il contributo di Demosthenis Papadatos sulla Grecia, sulla situazione greca. Devo dire subito che Bernard Heinzelmeier, che avrebbe dovuto svolgere il caso nazionale dell'Austria, per ragioni di salute non può essere qui con noi e quindi non abbiamo. Poi se nel dibattito vorrà dire, nella tavola rotonda finale vorrà dire qualcosa Walter Baier, essendo Walter austriaco, è stato segretario del Partito Comunista Austriaco, direttore di Transform Europa attualmente. Bene, allora stamattina riprendiamo il caso nazionale rimanente, l'Ungheria. Sapete dell'importanza dell'Ungheria e ci sarà la relazione di Adam Fabbri che ci ragguaglierà appunto sulla Ungheria. Subito dopo avremo due relazioni importanti che arricchiscono questo quadro e ricordo che il nostro convegno vuole essere un convegno di studi e quindi di conoscenza e di approfondimento su tutti questi fenomeni, populismi e estreme destre, ma poi appunto avere una parte finale che sono i compiti della sinistra, come la sinistra europea, le sinistre europee si attrezzano per affrontare questi problemi. Avremo due relazioni importanti, Saverio Ferrari, vi ho detto, questo panorama europeo, e Tilo Jansen, come l'estrema destra populista, eccetera, è rappresentata al Parlamento europeo, perché non sono extraparlamentari, noi sono ben insediati nelle istituzioni, sapete, addirittura sono al governo, queste forze sono forze governative anche in varie parti d'Europa. Subito dopo, appunto, il dibattito politico, capire un po' come, appunto, come sinistre, cosa occorre, cosa si dovrebbe fare, come ci si attrezza. Allora, pensavamo di fare in questo modo. In questa mattinata c'è spazio, forse, ma lo vedremo rispetto ai tempi, Yanis Stavrakakis, che è greco dell'Università di Salonico, primo discorso, chiamiamolo politico, di proposta culturale, di proposta più vasta, e poi facciamo l'intervallo. Dopo l'intervallo riprende Elisabeth Gauthier, Transform e Spasmarx, e Mimmo Porcaro, dopodiché tavola rotonda finale coordinata da Walter Baier, e avremo le nostre interlocuzioni con Luciana Castellina, Klaus Sühl, Nicola Nicolosi. Io ancora non ho visto Marga Ferre, che è partito della sinistra, non c'è, that is not, ok, Marga non viene, e quindi saranno queste persone, questi nostri ospiti, che discuteranno alla fine, con questa tavola rotonda finale, le sfide per le sinistre europee, nuove prospettive e nuovi compiti, naturalmente. E così concluderemo. A nome della Fondazione Rosa Luxemburg, di Transform Europa e di Punto Rosso, vi ringraziamo per essere intervenuti. Vi ricordo che è importante compilare la scheda di partecipazione, chi non l'avesse, le facce nuove che vedo stamattina, per favore compilare la scheda di partecipazione e poi lasciarla al banchetto qui fuori. Al banchetto qui fuori ci sono vari libri e vario materiale, anche omaggio la rivista di Transform, la rivista di Transform, che è in omaggio in inglese e in francese, e c'è questo numero che ha trattato proprio di questi temi, che è oggetto del nostro convegno. Bene, io per il momento, poi ci sono altri avvisi. Adam Fabbri è ricercatore universitario, conosce molto bene l'italiano, ma interverrà in inglese, e vi prego, forse qualcuno, facce nuove, non ha preso le cuffie, vi prego prendete le cuffie, c'è la traduzione simultanea inglese, italiano, italiano, inglese, grazie a Linda Canali e a Gabriella Vanzan, le nostre due brave traduttrici. Poi l'applauso lo facciamo voi sapete com'è importante il lavoro di traduzione, che non è semplicemente un lavoro tecnico, ma è un lavoro, come dire, anche di conoscenza più vasta, e quindi è importante. Allora, io direi, Adam, la parola a te, l'Ungheria.
Grazie Giorgio. Yes, I will be speaking in English, although I speak Italian as well, fluently, but I prefer to speak in English nonetheless. The working title of my presentation here today,
China.
Can everybody hear me? Yeah. The working title of my presentation is "Nach Rechts: Demystifying the Rise of Populist and Far-Right Movements in Post-Transition Hungary." The main points that I want to make with in this presentation is to explain to you what the current conjuncture, the political conjuncture, how it is in Hungary, and how we can understand it. And I won't go into a long theoretical debate about populism and so on and so forth. But what I do want to point out, the second point, is that I don't think that, although Hungary might be at the moment the most reactionary state in Europe, I don't think that it's an exceptional case. I rather think it's a symptom of deeper problems within liberal democracy and capitalism in general. Okay, so let me begin with some of the worrying signs at the moment. Something I think is definitely rotten in Hungary today. If we go back to April 2010, that was the time when the conservative Fidesz-KDNP coalition, led by the mediagenic Viktor Orban, was swept back into power in Budapest. Riding on a wave of popular discontent against the corrupt and politically bankrupt socialist liberal government, they won a two-thirds majority in parliament. Now, once Orban came into power, he promised to radically transform the Hungarian state. And he did this by implementing in proper Orwellian language a so-called national system of cooperation in the name of national renewal. The current government has indeed been moving very quickly to fulfill its promises. If we look at the package of laws, the ordinances and the personal changes that have been taking place in the last 18 months, then I think it reads more or less like the minutes of a top-down coup d'etat. So, I mean, the list of the Orban regime's misdeeds is very long. I won't list all of them. I will just mention some of the most important things that have taken place. To begin with, the new government has placed loyal party apparatchiks in the corridors of power, including the presidency, the State Audit Office and the Constitutional Court, as well as in top positions in cultural organizations such as the state media, the film industry and universities. Dissenting voices in the academia are persecuted and meticulously silenced. Now, Giorgio told me in our discussions before this meeting that he was a big follower of George Lucas. Well, everybody who is interested in the writings of George Lucas, I'm sorry to tell you that the George Lucas archives in Budapest, which were formerly part of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, have ceased its scientific editorial and publishing activities from the 1st of January this year. The government shut it down on the grounds that it did not contribute to any scientific work whatsoever.
It goes without saying.
Yeah, I mean, I'll remain no comments on that one. The socialist opposition has been criminalized. There is, for example, a new law in Hungary now, which enables the successor party of the old party state, so the current socialist party, can now be held accountable collectively and individually for so-called communist crimes committed before 1989. Also, a new media law was passed in 2010, which empowers a new and all-powerful media authority, headed, of course, by loyal Fidesz members, with the responsibility to, I quote, maintain the undisturbed operation in compliance with pertaining legislation in force of the media and the markets for electronic communications, postal and information technology services. So basically, this is a one-party authority which has the right to completely arbitrarily impose hefty fines on improper speech, whatever the authority considers improper, and deny any media outlets of the renewal of their licenses. And there was a very famous case just before the turn of the year in Hungary with basically the only opposition radio channel that still existed, the Klub Radio, was shut down on using these laws. It's also, I mean, the new government has not been really resting on its laurels when it comes to restructuring the Hungarian economy either. It has been pursuing quite vicious neoconservative policies, trying to maintain a balanced budget, establishing a new flat tax rate system, firing civil servants en masse, slashing welfare benefits, introducing workfare programs, and so on and so forth. I won't go into detail about that right now. I think that the key, what we in Italian we would call the il sigillo di approvazione, of the new regime, was put in place on the 1st of January this year, when the new Hungarian constitution, the so-called fundamental law of Hungary, came into force. Again, I won't go into detail about the constitution, but I think its most conspicuous feature is that it breaks completely with the secular notion of the state, which I mean, has more or less remained a key feature of liberal democracy since the French Revolution, I think, in favor of an ethnically suffused conception of the state. Moreover, it eliminates all guarantees of the welfare state. I mean, this is a very gentle European version of liberal capitalism. And so in that sense, the Orbán regime represents a change not only in substance, but also in degree to previous governments, post-transition governments in Budapest. The government is also in cahoots, in cooperating with the xenophobic and openly, well, I mean, more or less openly anti-Semitic Jobbik party, which is, as you might know, it's the third biggest party in parliament, having gained almost 17% of the votes in 2010. It's also sitting in the European Parliament. And Jobbik is a very interesting phenomenon. Although its style, its rhetoric is more similar to traditional fascist parties in Italy and Germany, it has, through the help of its charismatic and young leader, Gábor Vona, it has successfully managed to integrate the key points of the party's manifesto, such as the need for a strong state, authoritarian strong state, economic protectionism, and major irredentism. All these points have been integrated into the mainstream political agenda in Hungary. Opposition to the regime, the which has, I mean, there has been, thanks God, well, thanks. There is opposition to the regime, but it's quite, I mean, weak for a number of different reasons, and they're constantly portrayed as attacking Hungary. So they are portrayed in Hungary as national traitors, and so. I mean, the parlementary opposition is, as I said, is weak and it's constantly fighting with its within its own ranks. The trade unions are more or less on their knees, and the so-called the self-proclaimed representatives of civil society are some of them are asking for, and now I quote here, the establishment of a permanent crisis council comprised of credible and proven economic and financial experts, and the transfer of control over economic policy to a crisis council. And both of these points they were asking for with exclamation marks. So a complete transfer of any form of the little democratic influence that you can have over economic policy to a completely technocratic body. I mean, I think personally that's very problematic, but anyhow. So how can we understand this radical shift to the right that has taken place in Hungary? And the question is even more interesting, because Hungary is the supposed poster boy of neoliberal transformation in Central and Eastern Europe. So how could this take place in Hungary? Well, I mean, whether consciously or not, mainstream commentators, both liberal and conservative, tend to, when they speak about Hungarian events, they tend to obfuscate economic and the relationship between economic and political developments. So, if you read about Hungary in the international press and also in the communiques that are coming out from Brussels and Washington and so on and so forth, you're often given the impression that you're somehow tempering with a petulant population which is narcotized by the promise of national renewal and that has abandoned any sense of political reason, and not with political struggles which, at least according to the Marxist literature, are normally shaped by the contradictory developments of the economy. So, in the mainstream literature, the drift to the right in Hungarian politics is conceived as an exception to the liberal capitalist norms of governance in Europe, and not as a deeper symptom of deeper problems in the structure as such. I mean, I think I don't have time to go into some of the bizarre examples. I just want to mention one of the bizarre results that we can see of this type of reasoning, and that was when during the sort of guerra di parole that took place between Brussels and Budapest in earlier this year. One of the most common explanations of events in Hungary in the mainstream media was that Orbán was personally responsible for all the, I mean, for the rightward drift in Hungary, right? So there is this fantastic quote from the left liberal German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung, which accused Orbán of being quote, infected with a Bonaparte virus and misusing his two-thirds majority in parliament to subordinate the state to himself and to his party. I think this type of description of the events in Hungary is not very useful at all. What is the mainstream, what are mainstream commentators and political parties providing as a solution for events in Hungary. Well, I mean, the bizarre thing there is that they are demanding so-called responsible statesmen as Cameron, Merkel and Sarkozy to reel in Orbán before his authoritarian virus becomes contagious. Well, I mean, I think this is highly hypocritical. If we're seeing Cameron and Merkel and Sarkozy and company as the defenders of democracy, I think the situation is quite grave, to put it mildly. So where else can we look then to move beyond this political and also theoretical impasse with regards to Hungary? I think that the old, I mean, in this case, the old Marxist notion of totality still seems quite pertinent here. I think that the rise of what we have described here as populist and far-right politics, they cannot be isolated to a single factor. I mean, it's not because somebody gets a virus that you then the day after wake up and decide to completely disband all democratic norms in a country. But they need to be understood in relation to wider economic, political, and social and cultural developments. And when I speak about these developments, I mean the big, the word with the capital, I mean the big capitalism, I mean that's what I'm speaking about. I mean, as the famous German philosopher Max Horkheimer once wrote, you know, he said, anyone who does not wish to talk about capitalism should also be quiet about the subject of fascism. So I think we need to try to dissect the relationship between the two. And if we follow this type of reasoning, I think we can see that the rise of new, more aggressive right-wing political forces in Hungary must be sought in the confusion that has followed in the wake of the democratic turn in 1989. Because, I mean, what was the meaning of 1989? As the radical Hungarian philosopher Guillaume Tamás very cogently, I think, pointed out a couple of years ago, the idea of 1989 in the mainstream literature was that this was the demise, this represented the demise of actually existing socialism and the re-establishment of normality. Normality being parliamentary democracy, free market capitalism, and unconditional allegiance to the West. I mean, the zeitgeist of the period that has followed since was, I think, most accurately summarized by Francis Fukuyama's famous end of history thesis. So in line with following this line of reasoning, 1989 was perceived as the annus mirabilis, when the wonderland of free market capitalism and liberal democracy was opened for the ex-Soviet satellite states in Central and Eastern Europe. Now with more than 20 years of hindsight, we know that this whole project turned out to be a mirage. This idea turned out to be a mirage. The neoliberal experiment in Central and Eastern Europe turned out to be a complete failure. I just want to briefly... I won't go into, it turned out to be a complete failure from economic, political, and social point of view. So this, I mean, it is against this background that the populist and far right enters the political arena in Hungary. Because Orbán and his supporters further to the right on the political spectrum, they seek to represent themselves as the political force that embodies the energies of the disgruntled Vox Populi. Fidesz and Jobbik, then, are calling for a moral revolution in Hungary. They are conservatives in appearance only, in the sense that they appeal to law and order, the family values, hierarchy, and so on and so forth. But in reality, they seek to delegitimize the notion of social responsibility for those who are by now excluded from the sphere of subjugated work. And this is a quite important break with Christian democracy, traditional forms of Christian democracy. So the revolutionary, or in reality the counter-revolutionary cry of the Nova Destra in Hungary is, who is not worthy of our assistance? And the main targets here are in line with vulgar reactionary traditions in the region: the Roma, the Jews, or those who are not able to work, the sick and the old. I mean, we can see similar trends in Western Europe as well, but there the targets are slightly different, because I mean it's predominantly aimed against Islam, basically, is the main target. And I mean, these ideas are not necessarily new either. I mean, they're not special for Hungary. These ideas have been pioneered by neoconservatives in the academia, such as Samuel Huntington, Bernard Lewis, but also in politics for a long time, people like Thatcher and Reagan and so on and so forth. However, we should not forget that social democracy, in its various forms in Europe, has also proven more than able to play to the same tunes. And here I just want to mention, you know, the example of Blair in Britain or so on and so forth, but we can speak about that in more detail. So, just to wrap up quickly then, I don't think Hungary is in this sense then an exception. It is rather a symptomal state of the failures of liberal democracy and neoliberal capitalism. What sets Hungary out, apart from the other countries on the continent, however, is that the reaction in Hungary is much more conscientious and organic than elsewhere. I mean, it's not just that Fidesz controls 2/3 of the parliament, and in addition to that, 93% of local governments are in Fidesz hands. 93, I repeat. Okay, that's not just 2/3. The changes in Hungarian society go much deeper than that. I mean, street names are being changed. Statues are being erected for heroes, for war crime heroes. So the last remnants of progressive democracy in Hungary are being, as we speak, are being demolished in outside of the Parliament Square in Budapest. The statues of Károlyi, Attila József, and so on and so forth are being removed as I speak to you today. And the far right is at the same time being offered new theaters and so on and so forth in Budapest to express its ideas. Culture and education, as I said, is being reformed in line with the ideas of the conservatives in power, and there is also a new constitution, as I said. The problem is, of course, that the Hungarian public doesn't get a very nuanced view of everything that of these things that are taking place because of the new media law and so on and so forth. So, in light of all this, I think that I mean opposition to the regime and the far right in Hungary is very very difficult. And if I can conclude on this, I mean, I'm completely in support for international solidarity in all its different forms. Right now, especially with the Greek workers and strikers on the streets of Athens and Thessaloniki and so on and so forth. But empty phrases of the need to build a united front and so on and so forth are not going to count for very much for the people that are in the first line of attack. From the far right and the populist right in Hungary, so I think we need to think beyond these phrases. Thank you.
Grazie Adam Fabbri, un bel quadro, sempre preoccupante, anche se non sono senza la categoria di eccezionalità è ancora più tragica. Allora, abbiamo finito la parte dedicata ai casi nazionali. Ricordo che noi abbiamo progettato di utilizzare i materiali del convegno per un libro che apparirà in inglese, quindi europeo, ma poi faremo l'edizione italiana. E in questo libro utilizzeremo molti materiali che non sono stati riportati nelle relazioni dei casi nazionali, perché abbiamo distribuito ai vari esponenti di Transform eccetera in tutta Europa il questionario che deve come dire, rendere conto dello stato di ogni paese per quanto riguarda appunto l'estrema destra e le destre populiste. Questi materiali poi saranno raccolti nel libro, quindi avremo un quadro veramente più largo. Adesso cominciamo la parte, diciamo, con le due relazioni finali che ci danno il quadro e poi proseguiremo con la discussione politica. Saverio Ferrari, Osservatorio Democratico, Der Spiegel l'ha intervistato e assurto a, come dire, esperto europeo. Dopo i fatti in Italia e Casa Pound eccetera, Der Spiegel l'ha intervistato e quindi non è solo, come dire, un esperto italiano, da sempre studia questi fenomeni, e a lui abbiamo chiesto proprio un panorama dell'estrema destra europea, est e ovest, avremo questo affresco. Vai Saverio.
Sì, la mia relazione è scritta, quindi la leggo. In Europa populismo, nazionalismo, estremismo di destra e neonazismo, per quanto continuino a rappresentare fenomeni specifici e distinti, tendono sempre di più ad accavallarsi, a sovrapporsi, mescolandosi l'uno nell'altro. Lo studioso francese Pierre Milza, docente di storia contemporanea, in un lungo e articolato